This is an interview with Mrs. Nellie Dinebossel for the Youngstown State University Oral History Project by William Manser at Youngstown State University on March 25th, 1974 at 8:05 a.m. Mrs. Dinebossel, what changes that have occurred since you first came to Youngstown have impressed you the most?
True music training that way. They weren't interested in public school music. That hadn't developed yet. So in 69, Mr. William Dana founded the school. Now his father was a very prominent man in Warren, Julius Dana. And he was very much against musicians. In those days, musicians were considered just like drunkards. They thought of them as no count. And Mr. Dana's father was the president of the bank and an officer. And he didn't want his son to be a musician. But William Dana decided he wanted to anyway. So he started, he got a room in one of the buildings down in Warren above the bank where his father was connected. And he started his music school. His idea was that if you were going to be a musician, you should have a private lesson every day on your subject, a private lesson in every subject you had, not just once a week like conservatories were in those days. So that was his idea, and so the Dana School of Music was called the music school where everyone took a lesson every day. It was an everyday problem. Well, Mr. Dana's father, Junius, was quite a strong man. He said he let his son live at his house, but he says, "You can eat at my table, you can sleep in your bed, but do not speak to me." He wouldn't speak to him. He said he didn't want to converse with him at all. So one day the music school was having a rehearsal of the Messiah, and they were singing the Hallelujah Chorus, and Mr. Dana's father came up, and Mr. Dana saw his father standing back there. He says, "Offer this man a book. Maybe he'd like to listen." And from that day on, his father changed and he supported the music school. He even used to play cello. He was a cellist himself. He liked music, but he just didn't believe in it as a profession. So that's the way the Dana music whistle. And they say that you can whistle ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta any place in the world and you'll have an answer from a Dana student. And so that came about in this way. Mr. Dana's father was playing the cello. This day they were rehearsing and he was absent. And when this little part comes in one of the symphonies of Haydn. And when it was time for the cello, Mr. Dana's father was there. So one of the students whistled this little phrase, and from that day on it became the sign for the music students to whistle to each other, see. Well, the school developed. They had people from all over the world. We had students from the Philippines, from China, from England, all over the United States. It was a well-known school. And in fact, Dean Aran, when he was working on his master's work up in the University of Michigan, it was mentioned that Dana and Oberlin, of course, and Cincy were three of the oldest music schools in the country. Now, as I said, primarily the music school was for professional training. I first went to the music school just about before the armistice was signed, 1918. And at that time, of course, enrollments were way down. There were hardly boys at all, just young boys. And at that time, they were selling those Liberty Bonds, you know, to make money for the war. The Dana students used to go to the theaters in between shows. They would sing Laddie and Cocky, It's a Long, Long Trail of Winding. Those were some of the old songs and some of those other songs that were so familiar in the First World War. it seems to me, since I started in music, we've had one war after another. It's always been war. Well, anyway, the enrollment was way down. Things were pretty bad economically. Well, then the Depression came on. And that was a rather bad thing because people were out of money. As you know, the banks closed up and we just didn't have the enrollment. And about 1931, the idea of having public school music began. And when public school music developed, the conservatories had to connect themselves with some academic institution to get the English and the other subjects. Up to that time, music schools didn't have to have any English or history or anything. So a lot of them, like Cincy, were affiliated with the University in Cincinnati. Of course, Oberlin had their own, but we had to get some academic work. So the first chance we had, we got from Hiram College. Hiram sent over some of their people. They had a branch in Warren, and it was developing very well. But President Fall of Hiram decided that that branch was going to become bigger than the campus school, and so he discontinued it. Well, that meant we had to get somebody else to furnish our academic work. So then we got Kent State. They had some people that came over, you know, and offered courses of English and history and so on. But finally, you see, things were sort of bad because we didn't have just the affiliation we should. And that was one of the reasons why we had to come down to Youngstown in 1941. So that brings us up to about 1941, when we had to come down here to get affiliated with a school. Now, does that give you a little idea of what we had to go through with when we were in the old school? Mm. It was very well known, though. It had a very good reputation, as I say, as one of the oldest ones. We are older than Juilliard, we're older than the Eastman School of Music. Those are just youngsters beside the Dana. And of the 100-and-some years the Dana is, I spent around 50, as you can see, 50 years in action with it. So it's just been quite an important part of my life, and I have seen a lot of changes in it. Now that brings us to 41. Now you want to know some of the important things that we've have been a change. Now, the first thing I mentioned was we had to have an academic affiliation. Now, when we came down in 41, that was just about the time, as you know, when we got into the World War. Yeah, because the fall of 41, Mr. Dana was supposed to be the head of the music school. He passed away just before the school was moved down here. He died suddenly. So Dr. Henry Stearns was made head. He had been in charge of the music department at the college here, as Youngstown was called, Youngstown College. He was in charge of the music department, so made him head that year. But the following year, Arnold Hoffman became head. Now, of course, after Pearl Harbor, the military took over up to the building. The Dr. Jones had bought this building, where the music school is now on Wick Avenue, for the music school. And we were there one year. I used to have my classes there and everything. I taught theory and harmony and so on. And when the military took over, that became a link training school for Air Force people. They had those link trainers in the rooms up there at the music school, and the upper floors were used for dormitory. It was off bounds to anybody, so we had to have all of our classes down in Jones Hall. It wasn't called Jones Hall in those days. It was just the main building, as we always called it. So I taught down there till during the war. And of course, I think one of the outstanding persons who did the most for this school from that time when we came down to the time it became a state university was Dr. Howard Jones. Now, as I said, in 41, you could walk, 42 really, when the war started, you could walk through the halls and hardly meet a person. The enrollment was way down. Everybody was in the army and just a few girls around. And however, though, we never missed a pay. Dr. Jones really had a problem. He had to raise all that money, do you see, to keep the school going. So that was one of his big problems. But in spite of that, he'd take over the music school, which would be an added economic problem. And then in 44, before the war ended, he started the School of Engineering. Now that was another big adventure. But of course, during the war, the industry was making money in those days. I guess that's about the only place where you could say they made money, and that was in industry. And so industry financed the beginning of the engineering school, which was a big step. We used to have that in what was called Old West Hall, down in the basement, where the old snack bar used to be. That was the first engineering school. And I have a page from the Vindicator, reviewer section, going all of this, and I am at the cathode ray oscilloscope with Miss Guarneri, who was one of our faculty members, singing into it, and the engineering school really got started then in 44. And that was a big undertaking, too, for him. Then he not only did that, he raised a lot of money for the Youngstown Educational Foundation. Now you know of it. So when we became a state, that money went into the Educational Foundation. And that is really a very important thing. So, and then not only that, but Dr. Jones had built some buildings. We had the library, we had the science building. Then later on, they added this Ward Beecher one, and also the last building before we became a state was the engineering building over there. So you see, not only that, but he acquired other properties around for the music school, the Linder House up there, the Dana Recital Hall. We added on to the auditorium. And it seemed that's another thing. We were always building something. If it wasn't built or some kind of a machine going to interfere with your classes, and that's what it was when they added on the auditorium there. That was really, you know, a lot of noise. You'd hear all this, and I had my class right above it all. But that's the way it is. Nowadays, we have to tread through the mud. But Dr. Jones, of the one person with this institution, probably did the most for it, as you can see. Or we wouldn't have the institution we have today if he had just let things go back in the wartime. Now, what other things would you like to have me give you?
Since we were talking a little bit of Dana, what attitude or what reaction was there on the part of the Warren community when they realized that Dana was going to move from their community down to Youngstown?
Well, they were pretty much put out, most of the people. They were very sorry to see Dana leave. And I think that was a very important thing because, you know, Warren was the original capital of the Western Reserve, and it became taken over from the Connecticut Land Company. And Warren was the original capital, and they have a lot of people there that were very much interested in history. But they were sorry to see Dana leave, but you see, Hiram had given up. We hadn't any way of getting the support from the academic there, so we just had to have some other means.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did the general students and faculty at Dana feel about becoming affiliated with Youngstown?
Well, I'll say this. Now, we didn't always get our pay before we moved down here. As I told you, things were economically rather bad. The enrollment had dropped at the music school because we didn't have the academic stuff. We couldn't offer the public school music. And there were a few people that went in for professional stuff. Because at that time, before we came down, as I told you, they used to have theater orchestras in every theater up in Warren. Big orchestras. Music at that time was really booming. You're too young to know about it, but the big theaters in Chicago and all of the big cities had enormous organs that featured the music. They'd have big orchestras, and that was important. Then the talkies came on. That really put an end to a lot of the professional playing, because the talkies had their music all cued in with their pictures, and you didn't have the demand for the orchestra, the organs, and things like that as attractions in the theaters. So it had to go then to public school music. And that was the important thing in bringing the institution down here. We had to have that academic work.
So there was more or less a change in curriculum too at the time.
Oh yes, yes, because you had all these academic subjects. You had to have the practice teachings needed for teaching in the schools. We used to do some of that in the public schools in around the area. Do you see? And they still do. The practice teaching is done in the schools of the area.
Well, how close a relationship the public schools did Dana have before that time?
Well, they tried to have, and they did have some courses. The normal school, they had what they called a normal school, like a lot of those county normal schools were back in those days, that offered some of that practice teaching. And Mr. Dana was president of the school board in Warren, so there wasn't any problem there. But you had to have more than just that. You had to have the other academic subjects, which you would have to have teachers for those. And that would have cost a lot of money, so we had to have some financing back.
Well, how much change was there in the kinds of music being taught at Dana at that time?
Well, the emphasis for professional work, of course, is on performance, as you know. We used to have a very fine orchestra. I played in orchestra for many years. We had a very fine band. We used to have guest conductors of various kinds, composers like Henry Hadley, and some of those to act as visiting directors. We always had a Wednesday night concert, and that was broadcast through the station down in Youngstown. You see, they had a line up to our music school every Wednesday night, and the people in Warren used to support those concerts. It would be standing room out in the hall to hear those concerts, and those were broadcast. But you see, the emphasis then changed to the public school stuff. And so with the public school stuff, you have all of the methods, you have the practice teaching, you have the academic subjects, and there is less chance of time to spend on the your instrument. If you were a pianist, you had a lesson every day. You were expected to practice 4 hours on the piano. Well, you know, if you had to do all of the others beside, you couldn't practice 4 hours and do your other subjects. So there is a change there, you see, from the professional type of training to the public school requirements that one has today. Of course, we still have people that go for a bachelor music, and there is more emphasis. And I will say this. Now, at the time when we came down in 41, we had to have no orchestra, no band. There were any boys or girls to play in them. Just a few, the aroma small. So we had to give up a lot of that. We didn't have the concerts. We weren't able to give opera, but now the music school has really come back to that, and I feel that they really do a wonderful job with their concerts, their ensembles of all kinds. So that period when we first came down was sort of bad, you see, wartime and all that.
What kind of reaction has there been in the professional music world to this shift in emphasis on music teaching from concentrating on the instrument to a more...
Well, general? Of course, the older ones, I think it's very, bad. They're getting back to it. Now, if you look at our music school, they have some wonderful concerts, and they have some fine faculty that are performers, do you see? So they're, even though they've had to give the public school music, because that is the field where most of the people will be employed, that nevertheless, they're getting back to more attention to the professional part, too. And as you notice, recently, we had the fine arts degree passed, that they're going to give a fine arts degree. Now, again, that will carry over not only into music, where a person wants to specialize more in the professional part, but it will go into art, where they want to be artists, not just the teachers in the public schools, and the speech and drama the same way. So that degree, you see, will help out in a professional way for all of those arts, as well as the Dana.
Well, since Mr. Dana was involved in the Warren School Board, did he have any influence, or did he use any of his influence to help push along this tendency for an affiliation with public school teaching on the part of school?
Well, I think he did with the practice. And another person that I might mention who helped is Mr. George Bratz. Now, Mr. Bratz is a retired music teacher. He was in school when I was. And then I had taught him for a couple of years after I was graduated from the school. But he was one of them that taught down here for the college before we came down. And he also was influential with Mr. Dana in getting the President Jones to take the music school over.
Who was more willing at that time to have Dana come down to Youngstown, President Jones or Mr. Dana?
Well, I think they both were.
Both equally well.
You see, Mrs. Jones is quite a lover of music, the president's wife. And I think she rather wanted the music school. Probably that made a difference, too,
Well, in what way was Mr. Best most effective in bringing the school down here?
Well, I suppose in just presenting the facts to President Jones and making him see. And, of course, being an old school like that, it had a reputation, you see, because it was pretty old when we came down here, from 69 to 41.
Was the Youngstown community at large aware that they were getting a school with such an illustrious background to come into their city?
Well, that's pretty hard to say. I've never been acquainted with the people in Youngstown, although we always had a lot of students. Came from here. They used to commute on the old Erie train until we moved down here. And then during the first few years when that war came on, I had to commute on the Erie to get down here. And that train, the 8 o'clock train, used to be an hour late, and I had a 9 o'clock class. I'd just get into the station and dash up in a taxi to get to class in time. And that was always filled with, it was a New York Chicago train. And as I say, it was an hour late, and there'd be a lot of servicemen on. You had to stand up, and it was really something. So The Youngstown people, and they're all graduates of the school from Youngstown, and I think they probably realized the importance of the school. They've still continued to come, and we have an enrollment with a lot of Youngstown people in it.
Do you think they played much of a role in helping to bring Dana to Youngstown?
No, I don't think. No, I think it was entirely with Dr. Jones and Mr. Dana and George helping out, George Bratz.
How did the students at Youngstown College react to having Dana come to the university?
Well, again, you see, being a war year, there weren't many students to complain about anything. So I guess they accepted it all right. I guess they were glad it came down. Those who wanted the music, they wouldn't have to ride the old Erie. They could get it right at home.
Well, did many of them show much interest in studying?
Oh, yes, those that were able to. Mm-hmm. You know, after the war, yes, the enrollment really increased after the war then. It built up. Mm-hmm. And as you notice, the music school is one of the areas today that the enrollment is not down like it is in the liberal arts and some of the other areas at the university here.
Well, at about this time, at about the time that the curriculum's changing at the Dana School and before, what were particularly the strong points of Dana's curriculum? What were the strong teaching points of it?
Well, we had some very fine teachers. The students were well trained in music. They had very good classes in ear training, harmony, all of those kind of things, orchestration, composition. We always have a program in which the students would perform their compositions, and some of them were very good. And they used to always, when they were graduated from the music school, had to play a concerto with orchestral accompaniment, or sing an aria if they were a vocal student. I know I started playing concertos with the orchestra when I was a sophomore. The Mozart and the Rubinstein. The year I graduated, I played the Tchaikovsky B-flat, and that was one of the first appearances of that around in this area. It had been performed in other areas, but I think I was the first one to perform that in this area. And then later on, it became quite a favorite with people.
So Dana brought new things to the area. What was the general reaction to this?
Well, you see, I'm not familiar with the Youngstown people.
Well, in Warren, too.
Well, of course, they were sorry that the music school had to move from Warren, that's true, but nevertheless, I think they were quite pleased that it was a part of the college and would not have to be given up. They had to do something. So I think they were pleased about it, but they've always been sort of sorry we had to move down here.
Well, how much support in the Warren community in general and the business community in particular did the Dana School get while it was in Warren?
Well, oh, you know how it is. They say a prophet is not always accepted in his own country. They liked the school, but they didn't always want to get back of it financially. They did some to a certain extent. But if they had really gotten back of it, I think it would have made a difference.
Well, how much was the school in need of financial backing then?
Well, as I told you, we go months without any salary before we moved down here. And after I moved here, I never missed a salary check. The old Prentice saw to it that people were paid.
Well, I believe the Danas had some sort of political connections. I think William Dana ran Congress one time and so forth. But, I think one of them ran for mayor at one time.
He might have. He was a great person to go around and talk.
Yeah.
He was a very good talker, and he was always taking off on tours, of either concert or speaking tours, maybe different for Congress. We didn't worry much about his political or so in those days.
Do you think this gave him connections with the Warren community that might have gained support for Dana?
Well, yes, some, but I don't know. No, I don't think it would have too great a bearing on the support.
Well, as far as the teaching areas that, and the music education areas at Warren, that the Dana School was strong in, I think one time they were noted for their military band.
Oh, they always had an excellent band. Oh, yes. And we would have guest conductor like Goldman and all those people come for special concerts. Oh, yes.
Why do you think Dana was particularly strong in this area?
Well, again, it's a professional thing, and there were bands in those days like Krill's band and Goldman's band, Sousa's band. In fact, my theory teacher played horn with Sousa in the summer season. You know, he would go and play. Even he had toured with Sousa quite a bit. And they were just interested in that sort of thing in those days.
What areas of music education were the most prestigious at Dana?
What?
What areas of music education were the most prestigious at Dana at that time?
Well, I think you find this, and we have a lot of students in all of the public schools around here. You can hardly mention one that I haven't had as a student since I've been there so many years. And they've all been, I think, they know music as well as the other things. So many times you find that in some of the other schools, they weren't too well trained in the music itself, the performance. So I think our students were able to perform as well as to teach music, which is very important. And we had some very fine faculty members too that were good teachers.
What areas of music education ranked relatively low in prestige at that time?
Well, I can't think of any specific area, no specific area.
What areas were most popular with the students?
Well, the students, I think, liked the instrumental pretty well, but of course one has to have both. They have to take all kinds of methods nowadays. Even though you might be majoring in the instrumental stuff, you do have certain methods, and you have to have some voice. So on, you see, so you can do some of that work.
How satisfied in general were the Dana students with the curriculum as it was then? Was there any degree of dissatisfaction?
No, I don't think they were dissatisfied as long as what we had to offer them at the time was all right, but they just had to have the other academic stuff, and that was a big problem. You had to have the academic, and that's where we were forced to get other work.
Okay, what changes in the biology department have most impressed you since you have been associated with it?
Now to start back again, we'll have to get back to that first, the war. When I came down here in 41, Willard Webster, you know Willard, who was head of the athletic work, was the only biology teacher. Dr. Siemens, who had been head of the department, had gone into the Department of Agriculture to do quarantine work, you know, during the war. So Willard was the only one teaching any biology. We also had a man named Dr. Waldron, who taught the general science, it was called in those days. And teachers had to take a certain amount of that, you know, the public school teachers. But he had to go into training Navy men, so he couldn't teach that. And I had just finished up on my master's degree in biology and chemistry at Kent State in 42. That was the year, you see, when we had to start on our war activities. So they asked me then, they practically knew I'd gotten my degrees now in science, whether I would take the general science. So Willard and I used to do all of the science teaching. Well, then after the war, Dr. Worley came back. Dr. Worley, Claire Worley, had been in the Department of Agriculture. He'd been sent down to Haiti to do some work down there. So after the war, he came back and became head of the department. So gradually, it started to build up. And of course, he passed away very suddenly. And Dr. Charles Evans and even Willard Webster had charge of the department as acting chairman for several years until Dr. Kelly was appointed. And then finally, we have Dr. Van Zandt. Now, when we first started, of course, in those days, you had the biology majors who were majoring biology, maybe to teach in the public schools. You had some pre-med students. You had some pre-dent. Now, today, and the enrollment of our majors today is 350. But of that number, probably many of those are in the nursing program. They're pre-dental or pre-medical students. And you can't really say that they're all just majors like they used to be for one reason. There's more of the pre-professional training and the two-year nursing program that has called for a lot of work from our department. So there's been a trend from just straight majors in biology to professional and pre-professional training. And you see, that accounts for a large number of those. So as Dr. Van Zandt said to me the other day, you just can't say how many of the 350 are just straight majors majoring in biology because they're in the professional stuff. Now you see, the nurses training now in the city of Youngstown has been given up at Northside, those schools, and those people come here now from the hospitals in Youngstown. So that accounts for a large number of our students. You see, we have so many. As you noticed, in the Vindicator yesterday, 108 graduating in nursing. Now you see, that's a large number. Well, our biology teachers have to furnish all of that, the anatomy, the microbiology for those nurses, do you see? And then besides all of the other professional stuff. Now we also have one change in the biology department. We have a curriculum in what is called pre-forestry. Now that's starting to build up. That was begun several years ago. Dyke Beatty was one that sort of advocated that. And we had a connection. He had talked to the Duke University. They have a forestry school down there. And it was through Dyke that we started this pre-forestry stuff. I was on the curriculum committee when we began that several years ago. And that's been an important thing, so we'll probably build that up, do you see, because a lot of people are going into forestry nowadays. Now, another thing, Dr. Van Zandt is on this board for the medical school. If we get a medical school, that would mean another area in which the biology department will have to furnish some of the classes, do you see, for the medical students.
I think it's a 4,500 tape.
Why did you turn the tape?
Well, I turned them in, that's what I do.
Did you take movies that I typed on the ones for showing?
Yeah, I did. Mrs. Dane Bossel, in what ways did the biology department adapt itself to the increasing inflow of medical pre-med students? In what ways did it try and develop a curriculum more suited to their needs?
Well, I think, of course, our faculty has enlarged a great deal from the time when I first came down here. At the present time, we have 16 full-time faculty members and 4 part-time. Now, we have also another course that we have to furnish, a service course, so to speak, for people that need a certain amount of biology as a requirement on their degrees. And so those classes are all quite large, and you see with the size faculty that we have been able to do that. Also, the nurses' classes, you see, are very large because the nurses all have to take 2 quarters of anatomy and physiology and microbiology. And so our faculty members, you see, have to be trained in that area. Most of them have their PhD, and the rest of them do have their master's degree. So that the enlarged faculty has helped out a lot. Now, I don't know what will happen if they get the medical school, whether we'll have to add more faculty or how that will be. But this course for the general students, as I say, the classes run very large. In fact, most of those are closed at the present time. Very few places.
Well, in what ways generally has the faculty changed since 1941 in biology?
Well, there's just more in number than anything else. We always had people with training in certain areas in biology. Some are in one area, not another. We have probably more research being carried on now. That's another factor. Several of our faculty members are quite interested in research. And that is a development that has developed in these last few years in most schools. You know, research has been the thing.
Hmm. Well, why do you think there's been such an increase in pre-med students and so forth?
Well, of course, you see, having all of those nurses put in has made a large increase in our enrollment in biology. And then, of course, I think there are just more people that are interested in going into medicine. Mm-hmm. We have med techs and all those different people to take care of.
Mm-hmm. At the time that the Dana School was becoming affiliated with Youngstown, Youngstown College was at that time becoming accredited by several agencies, higher education agencies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this influenced Dana's decision to move down here?
That was one thing. We belonged to the National Association of Schools of Music when I first started teaching, when I was in school. In fact, you don't remember Dean Dykema, who was Dean of the Liberal Arts here, Carl Dykema. Did you know Carl at all?
Oh, I knew by his name.
Well, his father, Peter Dykema, was one of the men that developed that Kalbasser-Dykema test for music ability, and he was at Columbia. And he was on the board of examiners for the National Association of Schools of Music when I first started teaching. In fact, he came into my classes and observed my teaching. But we were on that their list. We were certified by that association until about 1931, and that was, Depression time. Well, in 31, they had to cut down their staff at the Dana School. So for 3 years, I was out in public school music. They were getting, you know, in a bad spot from the Depression. But when the school went down in enrollment, and they had to have these academic subjects, that was another thing. We were taken off the NASM list because we didn't have the academic subjects. And so that was a big factor in coming down here. Well, after we were down here a few years, when I was acting dean at the Dana School of Music, the NASM examined us again, and we were taken into probationary membership for a couple of years, and then into active membership. So that was a very important factor. You had to be on the accreditation list of these schools, you know how it is in every area, whether it's engineering or music or what. You have to be accredited, or people just don't think you're doing your work.
Did this generate much faculty enthusiasm for the transfer?
Well, of course, I think the faculty did want to improve, that is, and to get this academic work so we could be back on to the accreditation agency's list, yes.
Well, how did the Dana people, the faculty and the students, feel about having somebody put in charge of Dana in 1941 who wasn't associated with it before?
Cooperated. They were good faculty members. They weren't like the people nowadays. We didn't have to start any particular association to put us forward, or we didn't call any strikes.
Mm-hmm.
We cooperated. The word was cooperation in those days. You cooperated to improve things. You just didn't find fault and strike about it.
What problems or difficulties did Mr. Stearns have in his right after the transfer?
I don't think we had any trouble. I think everybody was quite pleased. They were getting their pay, as I told you, and things were going a lot better than they had been heretofore with no chance of the academic work.
Well, Mr. Stearns had no particular administrative difficulties then?
No, we didn't have those administrative difficulties in those days. In fact, we didn't have the large number of administrators that you have today to find fault with. See? You better not quote me on that. But that is the point, you understand. No, we had a lot of cooperation. You had to have. Dr. Jones wouldn't have been able to build up this school if he'd had all those problems of dissatisfaction and so on. I think you ask most any of the old-timers, so to speak, that are around here, that there was a different feeling. You were working towards something and not against it. You see, that's a lot of difference.
Why do you think there was that attitude and there isn't it today?
People were different a little in those days. You're probably too young to know it, but they were.
Why do you think that was?
Well, it was just the attitude of the times. People weren't striking. You didn't have public school teachers striking. And even the kids didn't strike out against the teachers. Why, my goodness, even in the public schools in those days, they wouldn't have thought of hitting a teacher. If the teacher said you do something, you did it. There was a different attitude in general with people in those days.
Well, how was discipline taken care of at Dana?
No trouble.
No.
They were enthusiastic about their work. They didn't have time to get into a lot of monkey business. We had no streakers. All those kind of things. No, we didn't. They used to have their pranks, the boys, you know, after hours when they were up in their dormitory. They liked to play pranks with each other and things like that. And even I used to play pranks. I have to tell you about this one. I usually was pretty good at behaving. You know, as I said, we cooperated and tried to do what we should. There was a girl, and we used to have a practice rooms in the buildings at the old music school in Warren. Everyone had their practice room. There was one girl that was pretty fond of the boys, and she had a lot of friends, see. And you know, there's a tendency, even with the practice rooms up here, if you have a practice room, the boys like to drop in and see their girls. Well, that's a problem, too. At one time, Mr. Dana, the old Mr. Dana, I am told, had stairways on both sides of the building, and the girls had to use one stairway and the boys the other. They weren't allowed, and if they were caught in a girl's practice room, they were expelled. Old Mr. William Dana was quite a disciplinarian in that way, as far as the boys and girls were concerned, see, if you speak of discipline. But this time, One of my friends, who was from Youngstown here, and I, Gertrude Eason was her name, decided we'd have a little fun with this girl. And she had been going with a boy that played French horn. And there was a carpenter working up on this floor where her practice room was. And we had gone up and we had a sign that said, all men welcome. First come, first served. And we hung it on her door. Well, Mr. Dana was in New York at the time, and Prof. Cook, as we always called him, was in charge of the school. Well, the carpenter saw this man come up and look at the sign. He was up there, and he was looking at the sign, and the carpenter thought he'd put it up. So this girl, when she found it, she rushed down to Prof. Cook with that sign, and she said, that this boy, Bill Shank, her boyfriend, had put it up there because she had been, going out with another boy. And he was doing it to spite her, see. Well, Prof. Cook was one of those old sort of gentlemanly fellows, and he called Bill down and was going to expel him. And Bill said, no, he hadn't put it there. He hadn't done it. So finally, when we found out that Bill was going to be expelled, we went down and confessed that we had put it up. So we used to play pranks too, you know, have a little fun now and then.
Well, generally, what kind of relations existed between the faculty and the students at Dana? Was it pretty close?
They were very friendly.
Uh-huh.
We had parties, we had Christmas parties, we'd put on stunts. And that was a thing that we always did. Every class would have a stunt.
Mm.
For this party, and the faculty would have a stunt. So one time when the man I married was in school with me, his class put on a sort of a chorus girl show, and he was dressed in these short paper skirts, you know, and they were dancing around on the stage, and his paper skirt fell down, and there he was standing in his shorts. So we used to have a lot of fun that way. We put on stunts of all kinds, and there was a great deal of a friendship between the faculty and the students.
Was there much overlapping of social life?
Well, as I said, the faculty and the students, we'd have parties, uh-huh. And they'd both be there. Oh, my, yes. And even up till the time we came down here, we had parties and things like that. The faculty were always very friendly and social with the students.
Well, the people that were attracted to the faculty at that time, did they look upon music teaching as their career in life, or were they musicians who were simply doing that as a temporary thing?
No, I think you might say that their career was to teach.
Hmm.
Now, most of them have had professional experience. They had played in orchestras. They had played in various organizations. But they finally decided on teaching. And they were interested in seeing that their students got what was coming to them.
Mm-hmm.
That was their emphasis. They wanted to teach and produce good students.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody in those days had to have some professional background, you see, and training.
Did many students at Dana at that time aim at teaching as a career?
No, they didn't think of teaching as a career for the most part. It was performance. As I said, all their orchestras and bands where you could play and everything. So that's what they wanted to do, play.
Mm.
Oh yes, their emphasis was on playing.
I believe that Mr. William Dana was associated with the National Educational Association, and he helped start a music teachers association.
Yes, that's right, he did.
What in general was the attitude towards teachers association among the Dana faculty?
Oh, I think they all belong to the National Association of Schools of Music Teachers.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, did you see that? Just shut off your machine a minute. Yes, as you can see by that diploma, he was made a life member of the association that he was the founder of. But Mr. William Dana was also a representative of the Royal Academy of Music of England. In fact, when I was in school, they sent him a certificate showing that, and I haven't been able to find that certificate anyplace. You know, when we moved down, a lot of things were brought down. They just brought me that thing the other day, so maybe they'll find the other certificate. He was also given a citation at Bologna, Italy, for his work in music. So William Dana was internationally known person.
Did any important changes take place at the Dana School after he was succeeded by his son?
After when?
After he was, after his death, when he was.
Well, of course, his son, Lynn Dana Sr., became head. And he was a very well-known person, too. He was, an officer in the Music Teachers National Association. Oh, another thing. In Chautauqua, New York, every summer, we never had summer school until fairly just a few years before we came down here. Because in those days, the faculty played in the orchestra at Chautauqua, New York, every summer. And the Danas had charge of that, you see, of the orchestra. And all of our teachers played various instruments, you know, and they played in the orchestra at Chautauqua, always. So you see, they had professional practice in the summer as well. Of course, they gave recitals and things like the faculty do today after the school.
Was there any, what characterized the faculty's attitude towards the Dana's administration?
They were well known, yeah. Most of them, in the music field. Now, Miss Catherine Guarneri was a soprano, taught boys, and she would give recitals, sang an oratorio all over the country. She was well known. Mr. Dana went on tours. They all, you know, had their recitals and things that they gave all over the country. Oh, yes, they were well known in those days.
Why do you think? I believe that William Dana was well known for his prohibition stand and so forth. Did the Dana's attitude towards prohibition? How did that react? How did the students react to that?
Well, students react like they always do. Those boys had a fraternity, and of course they had a fraternity house, and they used to have their drinks just like anybody else. So, Mr. Dana, Lynn Dana, was not the strict disciplinarian that his father was. That made a difference. He didn't worry about those kind of things. Now, in Prohibition, you know, we had a place called the Hollyhock Gardens in Warren. Now, you probably don't know about that. But Hollyhock Gardens and Perry Como sang there. You know Perry Como that's still singing? Well, he used to sing down there when he was just a youngster. And that place had people from Pittsburgh and Cleveland and all over. It was a speakeasy. And they used to come over there to get their drinks during Prohibition. And Perry sang there. And that was a well-known spot in this whole area. They came from all around. So they were able to get their drinks all right. It didn't, Mr. Dana didn't make them quit.
How about the faculty today?
Well, I suppose they had theirs too.
Oh.
They wanted to. They were always pretty law-abiding people, but everybody had their bottles in those days, you know. Well, most of them did, didn't they? Except the WCTUers.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a friend that was one of those WCTUers.
Yeah.
And I used to like to put rum and other things in cooking, see. And we would invite them to dinner, and her husband used to look at me and wink. She liked our food pretty well, but she didn't know there was any rum or anything else in it. But that was it.
What changes resulted in the Dana School after the fire of 1937?
Well, it went on the same as usual. As soon as we got the fire debris cleared away, we went on with our work. It didn't hold us up in any way. I don't think we missed any classes. We went on as usual.
Did it destroy anything?
It was confined mostly to the auditorium, so you see. And then it did burn up into some of the practices above the auditorium. But outside of that, it wasn't too much damage. We could have our classes and so on. My room was in the front of the building. I could have my classes, even though the fire. You see, there was a long hall leading back to the auditorium, and our classrooms and things were up in the front there, so it didn't hold us back in any way.
How were the building facilities at the time? Were they satisfactory?
Well, it was all right. We had four floors in the building where we were. The Danas lived next door. Now, you know, the original Dana building, I should tell you about that. After Mr. Dana's father relented and went to aid the school, he bought a big mansion that was on the corner of Park Avenue and High Street in Warren. It had pillars. There were three of those buildings in Warren that had been built by some of those old founders. There was the Kinsman House, and that's one that's up on the Honing. Now, you probably have seen that building that has the four big pillars that's been renewed and renovated as a historical building. You've seen that, haven't you? Well, the Institute building on the corner looked like that. Now, the way it happened, and then there was the Quimby building. You know, the Quimbys were old-timers in the Western Reserve. And that house, which was like the Kinsman House, was over on West Market Street on the top of the hill. Well, this man that built this old building where the music school finally came to had wanted... He was in love with a certain girl in Warren whose parents had a lot of money. And he wanted to build a house that was good as that Kinsman House on North Honing. And so he got the same architect to design the building for him. It was a three-story house. It had those great big pillars on the corner there. And that was the building. And then during the Civil War, that was used as a hotel. It was called the American House, and people used to stay there. Well, then Mr. Dana's father, Junius, bought that for the music school. So when I was a youngster and first came to Warren, I remember seeing the Dana students. They used to have to wear uniforms in those days. They had a gray uniform. It was military in style. And it was treated braid and everything like that. It had the lyres on the collar, you know. It was a regular military type. Only the girls wore skirts instead of pants, because pants would have been out in those days. They wore skirts, but the boys wore the pants. But they had to wear that military coat and everything. They were regular military type of uniforms. And those were worn when I first came to Warren. Before I ever went to the music school when I was just a youngster. And as I said, Mr. Dana was a very strict disciplinarian in some respects, you see. So that building was finally torn down, and they had built a building back of it in which there are some commercial stores now. Then they built a cottage, which was called Junius Cottage, where the Danas lived. Then after that, they built two other buildings that are still up there on North Park. The one was the school, and the next one was a girls' dormitory. In those days, I said, they came from all over the country. You had to have, and that was a four-story dormitory for the girls in those days. Well, that finally was taken over by the YMCA, or YWCA. And the girls used to live then at the YW. And the building next to it was where the classrooms and the concert hall all were to be found.
Well, you mentioned earlier that some of the students at Dana were involved in fraternities. What kind of organizations did the students usually belong to besides fraternities?
Well, we had the boys' fraternity and the girls. Those were the principal ones.
Did much of the student social life at Dana center around the organization?
Not too much. They had their parties, but no, it was more general parties in general for the school. You see, in those days, our enrollment would probably run 100. Now, that's a small enrollment. So you can have parties that way. You can have parties for the juniors, so the seniors would have their parties, and so on. So that that was the way the social life went in those days.
Well, what general purpose did these organizations fulfill then?
Oh, just like the general fraternity. You know, they had their house, and the boys that belonged to it lived there.
Oh. Separated from the other
boys. Yes, that was up further. They had a house up on one of the other streets, you know, like to do nowadays.
Was there much friction or disagreement between the people who belonged to these clubs and those that didn't?
No, because there's only one boys' fraternity, and most of the boys belong to it.
Oh.
And most of the girls belong to the girls.
What's a particular reason why some of them didn't join?
Well, sometimes it was a matter of finance, but generally they were pretty nice to most of the people.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Dick, also, was it difficult for the university to gain support to build its present library?
The university in general?
Mm-hmm. To build the current library, the one that houses the building that houses the current library.
I don't know about that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that library. Now, that library, you see, is one of our projects since we became a state. That's a state project, I think. Our present library, even the one they're building out here.
No, the one that's already up.
Oh, well, I told you, Dr. Jones built up quite a bit of foundation, and all those buildings up to the present time were financed from the money that he had built up, millions of dollars. He worked very hard.
What particular problems did you encounter working on the library committee?
Well, we used to have a lot of meetings, and there's always the argument whether you have an open stack or a closed stack and a few things like that. But it was interesting, and we enjoyed seeing the library go up.
How long was that an issue, this open stack, closed stack question?
Oh, not too much of an issue. We finally decided on the open stack.
What people were interested in having a closed stack?
I don't recall that. I think most of them want the open stack.
What advantages would there be to having a closed stack?
I don't know. We didn't worry too much about that. That was the one matter that was discussed, probably. But we were just anxious to see how the bill went along, you know, and so on.
What kind of library facilities did Dana have? Did the Dana School of Music have when it moved here from Warren?
Well, very small. It was very limited in size. Most, as I told you, we didn't need a lot of academic material because we didn't have those subjects. See, if you aren't teaching English and all those things, you don't necessarily have to have to be a library of that type. It was mostly music recordings. We had a lot of when recordings came in, then we built up recordings and things like that.
Well, did the Youngstown College library facilities for general academic subjects such as English and so forth, did they fulfill Dana's needs in that respect?
Yes, we used those, you see. We had the library, when I first came here, was up on the fourth floor of Jones Hall. Mm-hmm. It was very small, even the college library. But that's one thing you have to build up, you see. And that was very small when you think of having just the fourth floor of Jones Hall for library space. Mm. It's nothing compared to what you have now. Mm. I think Dr. George Jones, who is head of the library here, has really built up our library. Very much. He's been very good in building up our library in general at the university here.
Well, what did the old music department at Youngstown, before Dana came here, did they have much in the way of library materials?
No. People had their own books in those days. Most of the faculty would have a nice library of their own. Hmm. But you didn't have that reference work that you had to do. See, when you're practicing on your instrument, you always bought your own music. You had all that to buy. You bought your own books. So people in those days, especially in music schools, didn't need the big library because you bought your own.
Mm. Huh. Now, Mrs. Dane Bossel, what problem particular interest did the music school have after it became associated with Youngstown?
Well, as I told you, after the war, when the veterans came back, we really enlarged our enrollment. My husband was in charge of the band then. We had a marching band of over 100 people. Now that was a big marching band. Of course, the veterans hated that. They hated to get out and march. They thought they'd had enough marching all their war years. But we had a good marching band to play at the affairs. Well, things were going along pretty well, and we wandered back in to this National Association of Schools of Music, which I told you we finally did. Well, when I was acting dean, Mr. Hoffman had been our director. We changed title names time and again around here. He was our director, and I was the assistant director. Well, then he took a position down in the Carolinas as head of the music in the state down there. And I was acting dean. They changed it. I was director right at that moment. I was acting director then. He left. So we were going to make application for the NASM, which we did. And Dr. Joseph Smith, who was dean of the college, went to the meeting where he and President Jones went to the meeting where we had put in our application. I didn't go, they went. And one of the conditions was, and this is where this idea of women and women's lib might come in, because I've had that problem ever since I been in things, that there has been prejudice against women. So when they would accept us after the examination, they told President Jones that they wanted a man for director. President Jones was going to let me be the director of the school. They didn't want a woman. They had to get a man. The practice didn't like it, but of course that was one of the stipulations. So we were to have to get a dean then. He was to become dean. So we interviewed some, and Dean Hugh Miller was the man we selected. And I was made then assistant dean. See, the practice said he'd make me assistant dean, but it could be the dean. Well, Dean Miller was quite a strict disciplinarian, and we had a man in our voice department, Mr. Kenneth Kitchen, a young man, and he worked to get Dean Miller out. He didn't like Dean Miller. Mm-hmm. And Dean Miller was, as I told you, pretty strict, but some of the faculty got up a petition that Dean Miller be removed. which they did. And I know that that was one of our big problems. So then I had to be acting dean until they decide whether they'd have somebody else for a dean, see. So finally, President Jones, and he was the one that selected people in those days. You didn't have any faculty committees or anything like that. He selected people. So he selected Kenneth Kitchen to be the dean, and I was assistant dean again. Well, Dean Kitchen had all the vices you can think of. He was an alcoholic, a homosexual, a dope addict. He was a bachelor. He lived with his adopted mother in one of the houses that the university owned, stood on the place where the science building now is. Mm-hmm. Oh, he used to call up the faculty at 3 o'clock in the morning and fire them. Oh, he was psychotic. And I thought he was going to end up at Woodside, which he finally did. Mm-hmm. They had to fire him. Mm-hmm. And he ended up, he was out to Woodside. Well, then he got better. And the man that directed the symphony before Tebow came offered to look after him. You know how they let people out. They had somebody to sort of vouch for them, so on. So the director of the symphony then said he would look after Kitchen. Well, Kitchen just about lived to his house, and the poor man was great straits having to do that. Well, we had to fire him. It was astonishing. Dean Dykema and I had to present the evidence and some of the things that he did to the faculty senate to show why he had been let out. Oh, he was a terror. Well, he went out west, and he disappeared in August of 1 year, and they found his body up in the mountains someplace around Los Angeles in about October. They don't know whether he was murdered or whether he committed suicide, but wasn't that terrible? Well, that whole business, he used to treat those poor students. He'd tell a student one thing one day, and the next day he said, I didn't say that at all. Well, we were losing students. That was our big problem. After we'd had this nice enrollment after the war, there he was, and the students just weren't coming to school. So we had to fire him. He was a very bad influence, you know. So then, after we got Dean Aran, things began to pick up again, and it's been very good since. And I think that acting Dean Bio is doing a very good job. I hope they'll let him stay as the head of the school, because he knows how to run the school, he has a good personality, and I think he gets along well with the faculty up there, and they should leave him where he is.
Why was Mr. Kitchen chosen to be dean of the music school?
Well, he used to go with the Presley's daughter.
Oh.
We'll put it that way.
Oh. Okay.
You know how that happens sometimes.
At any rate, upon what pretext was the previous dean, Mr. Miller, upon what pretext was he removed?
Well, Mr. Kitchen tried to say he wasn't running the school the way it should be, and oh, you know, you can always trump up a lot of charges if you're a psychotic personality. And that was the substance of it. I don't think the faculty that signed his petition had any idea that Mr. Kitchen was such a person. And in fact, this vocal teacher of Mr. Kitchen was fired. Dean Kitchen had said he was going to have him next year, and the poor man was counting on it. And here all of a sudden, he was fired. That was the way Dean Kitchen worked.
Where did his vocal teacher come from?
He was at Murray State College, see, and Kitchen had studied with him, liked him. Got him up here, he taught a year, and then fired him for no reason at all. He did so many erratic things. They just weren't logical, you know. As I told you, he called up Mr. Alvin Meyerowitz, the teacher a violin and fired him at 3 a.m. And he fired Madam Clava, who taught voice. We belonged to the AUP then, the American Association of University Professors. And she took up her grievance with the AUP in Washington. And of course, she didn't get fired then, because of that. But that was the way he worked, for no reason, no logical reason he'd do things. You couldn't have a person like that in charge of a school.
What particular complaint did the people who helped oust Dean Miller have against Dean Miller, besides that he was strict?
Nothing much. It was more or less Kitchen's shenanigans that got him out. You know how people can do. They start a something like that, and they can do a lot of damage.
As for the other problems involved after after Dana became associated with the college, what were some of the other problems?
I think that was the biggest problem that we had. After we got that straightened out, then the enrollment has increased, as you can see. We've had an excellent faculty. We've enlarged the faculty up there. We give operas, we give concerts. We have good organizations, ensembles of all kinds. So I don't think we have any problems. Oh, there are always, you know, little problems.
Did Dana have any problems getting support to put on concerts and shows?
No, I think the university has always been very good about cooperating with the programs that we have.
Did the School of Music have difficulty getting the proper books for the library? That you...
No, we've they have a very good record library there, and the library in general order all kinds of books for them. No problem that way. No, they're well supported. Up a bomb and kill the person.
Yeah. Is this based on anything factual, or is it just...
I don't know.
Well, I can
I
believe it's...
I should read it.